Let's see what the stew has in store for us today.
Welcome to the Gnomecast, Gnome Stew's Tabletop Gaming Advice Podcast. Here we talk with the other gnomes about gaming things to avoid becoming part of the stew, so I guess we'd better be good. Today, we have me, Ange, along with Jared, and a special guest for this episode of the Gnomecast. Welcome, Mike Shea from Sly Flourish. Mike, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and Sly Flourish?
Sure. As you said, Mike Shea. Been gaming a long time, since the late 80s, since the, when was it, 2008 or 9? I started a website called SlyFlourish.com, named after the Sly Flourish 4th edition D&D power, specifically writing articles about how to help game masters run games, then focus on 4E D&D. That transformed into 5th edition when 5th edition D&D came out, and now has expanded to kind of include all RPGs. So I talk about all RPGs.
I kind of miss Sly Flourish. I like that ability.
Yeah. I have heard rumors from time to time it shows up in playtests and then disappears from playtests. So
that's not right.
Yeah.
Of course, so, there's a lot of things. I also miss the, Jared, crap. What is he? He was the Warlord. I miss the Warlord.
Yeah. There's a lot of third-party products that have Warlord, and I think like the Bard has picked up. I think there's some subclasses for the 5th edition Bard that do Warlord-like things. And then, there's a few different 5e publishers who have made Warlord-style classes.
You say you got started in the late 80s. Was it pre-2nd edition? Or
it was right at 2nd edition. So I started by playing video games before I played the tabletop game. I was playing the Gold Box Pool of Radiance SSI game. And I didn't know what the hell is going on. And I'm like, I want to know why my armor class goes down and I don't get that's better. So I bought a 2nd edition player's handbook just to understand the math and the rules behind that game. And then managed to convince some of my high school friends to play in a campaign. They had, they had some experience with 1st edition, but I didn't.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I ran a little campaign in the middle of high school.
That makes me wonder how many kids out there in the last few years basically stumbled onto Baldur's Gate 3 and did the exact same thing.
A lot. Yeah, I have a friend of mine runs organized play games at PAX, the Penny Arcade Expo's various events.
Uh-huh.
And he says they have like new play ones and tons of people are showing up that have only played Baldur's Gate and want to know what that's like and go. So I think the world is a lot more free and open for people to learn how to play the game after a video game than it was when I was playing and there was no real connection between one or the other. So, And the other thing that I think is always kind of interesting is there's always this feeling that like the tabletop role-playing game led to the video game. And really, they were being developed simultaneously almost from the very beginning, right? The two of them were always kind of working together. I always thought that was interesting.
Yeah, I think even if we hadn't gotten D&D as a game, we probably would have gotten video games that were kind of fantasy-themed. They just kind of synergized well together.
Yeah, it would have been interesting. I wonder what would have taken the place of like hit points and armor class and things like that that you found in, I mean, Japanese role-playing games had them forever too, right?
Yeah.
And they got them from D&D, so it'd be interesting to see what they would get if it hadn't worked out that way.
So you are currently kickstarting The Rise of the Lazy Game Master.
Yeah.
Which is, I believe, the third in your series of previously lazy DM series.
I think it might be 6.
Ooh.
I was going to say, like, I can't remember for sure. Because I have the really old one.
So Lazy Dungeon Master. Now I got to count. You're going to make me count. Hang on. The original Lazy Dungeon Master, Return of the Lazy Dungeon Master, The Lazy DM's Companion, The Lazy DM's Workbook, Forge of Foes, and now Rise of the Lazy Game Master. So yeah, it's the sixth Lazy GM book.
I remember I read that very first one thinking, oh, this might be a little bit out of date because it wasn't until like 2017 or something that I got around to that.
Yeah.
And there was still a lot of stuff in that where I was like, oh, that still makes perfect sense.
Yeah, I mean, they're right. So it's one of the packages or several of the packages that we have on the Kickstarter include the original book, mostly as like a historic artifact. I actually released the text in a Creative Commons license. So anybody who wants to go read the book can just hit my website and see it and download it.
We actually have a question about that.
Yeah.
You released much of it for free.
I do, yeah.
What were your thoughts behind doing that?
I believe pretty strongly in getting the value of the material out as far and wide as I can and having it live beyond me. My father was an author, and after he passed away and I gained his estate, I did the same thing with his books, where I wanted the text of his books to kind of live. I didn't want it to be relegated to like maybe you could find a copy on archive.org if you look hard enough, and then it's questionable whether you should have it at all. I'm like, no, you should be able to have this book, right? Like, the book's been out a long time. And there's also part of me that feels pretty strongly about a lot of the ideas that are in my books are not like totally original ideas. They came from lots of places and lots of people. I want that to be open and available for other people to be able to build off of them. And I see a lot of it, like, where I used to get, and then thankfully I don't get it much anymore, of a lot of people who reach out, like, can I talk about the 8 steps of lazy GM prep in my thing? And I'm like, you know, I'm pretty sure I couldn't stop you, even, you know, I wouldn't, but if I'm pretty sure, like, if you describe them your own way, yeah, like, I can't, you know, I don't own the number 8, right? But I wanted to be explicit about that. And I think that's where these open licenses are really helpful, including like the licenses that Wizards of the Coast put out for their games, too, and everybody else's. It's not even necessarily saying like what's legally allowed or not allowed. It's about saying we are, instead of us potentially giving you implicit permission or you thinking maybe you can do it, we're going to tell you very specifically you can. So when we put out a document like that, what we're saying is like, you don't have to ask us about this stuff anymore. Anything that's in here, you can use in the stuff you have. Now, in the case of like Lazy Dungeon Master, it's released under a non-commercial license. So our intention is not that somebody should be able to download the whole book, make a new ebook, stick it up on Amazon, and then sell it at, you know, right next to the one that we're selling on Amazon.
Right.
But the intent of like, you should be able to go read the text on your own. You should download it to your own ebook reader if you want. You can see everything that's there and you can own it any way that you want to own it, short of selling it again. We chose that license for that reason. But we also have the Lazy GM's resource document, which has a lot of material that was published in, you know, some of the material from the original Return of the Lazy Dungeon Master and a lot of stuff from the Lazy DM's Companion and the Lazy DM's Workbook, where it's a lot of like random tables and it's a lot of core principles. It's much abbreviated from what's in those books. But the intention there is this is stuff you might want to actually put into a random generator and host online. This is something you might want to put into a commercial tool and sell it on Foundry. And that we didn't want to get in the way of even people making some making money off of it, because we're not going to build those tools. Right? I'm not building those tools. Right. Or even if I do, I don't mind if other people are building other ones, too. And I also don't know, like, can you legally own a table of 20 nouns? Like, I don't think so. So let me be explicit. Guess what? You don't have to ask, right? You get them. So that's a lot of my feeling on that. I don't want to get in the way of other people's creativity with stuff that I don't feel like I need to hold tight. Now, on the other side, like, I have the City of Arches, a campaign setting. I don't feel like I have to release that under an open license. I toy with the idea of, like, it would be kind of nice to have a primer for that I released under an open license. So if people wanted to build their own aspects to it, they could. Also, like, any of us can come up with a campaign setting. Mm-hmm. Like, I spent 2 years making it, but I didn't come up with some angle that I feel like would hinder other people's creativity if I didn't release it, because a lot of people have and can make stuff like that.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the thoughts that I go through with open licensing.
Yeah. And we're all of an age that we were around back in the day where we heard about TSR. They sue regularly.
Yeah, right.
They suing everybody regularly, right? For everything. And like, yeah. The actual legal fallout from that is you cannot copyright rules.
Kind of. Yeah, that never actually went to court and got judged. They all settled. All of those lawsuits ended up in small settlements. Other lawsuits kind of led to that idea that you can't copyright rules. But even that hasn't been proven quite enough in this space that somebody couldn't outmoney you.
That is true. That is true.
This was the importance of when you have a document like the 5.1 SRD that Wizards put out, or the 5.2.1 SRD that they put out. Now you know magic missile's fine, right? Mm-hmm. Like, maybe it was fine before. It wasn't a proper noun. Probably you're okay. Other people have used it and not used the license and they got away with it. But now you know, like, you know, if I have a question about it. So like when Kelsey Dione was making Shadow Dark, you know, she was building Shadow Dark after the fallout of the OGL catastrophe. And she was going to make, she had a lawyer, she had hired them. They talked about what they could and couldn't have in there, what you could call things and not. And she was, I haven't talked to her about this, but I think that this is true. She was pretty sure she was good anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But once it came out in Creative Commons, why not put a line in the beginning that says this material came from this system reference document? It's literally like 2 sentences and it covers her absolutely.
Yeah.
Right. Like now she doesn't even have to worry about it at all.
Getting back to the Rise of the Lazy Game Master, is this new book a revised version of older books, something new, or a little bit of both?
It's totally new. So a lot of the intention that I had when I sat down and started writing it was I wanted to make sure it fell into a specific slot. And that slot was it needed to be an independent book, where you could just buy it and use it on its own. You didn't need to have any other books. It's not a sequel to anything. And it also didn't invalidate or just rewrite material that had already been published in other books. So I really wanted it a different take. There's definitely overlap in this book with other books. For example, like the first several chapters are about the 8 steps for lazy GM prep, but they're all completely rewritten.
Mm-hmm.
And the intention for the rewrite was, we've now have 8 years of more experience with these ideas. There's lots of ways to that they have been expanded upon for people and that they can be expanded upon based on you, your desires for your group, where you are in your game session, what RPG you're playing, you know, lots of different factors that now we've got way more experience with that than we did when I wrote it originally. So there's some overlap there. But other than that, the books really take a different lens and a different focus on the whole topic of prepping and running RPGs in a unique way. Mm-hmm. So I feel that the book sits well alongside all of the other Lazy GM books, but also sits really well on its own. And that's kind of a hard thing to nail.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was not a strict rewrite of Return of the Lazy Dungeon Master. So I think it's about twice as long, too. It's about double the size.
So is there anything specific that you would point someone that has followed all of the other books towards in this that they specifically will get something new out of it?
Sure. So there's a few things. The book focuses on 4 big chunks. The 8 steps and how they've, you know, what we've learned using them over the past 8 years. Lazy campaign prep, which expands everything from the time you're starting to think about a campaign and putting a group together to running your very last session of a campaign. Adventure types, which are common. What are the common adventure types we often find ourselves using? How do they differ from one another when you're thinking about your prep and your play and what pitfalls they run into? And a lazy GM toolkit that has a whole ton of different things in them. Those last two are probably the ones that are most unique to this book from the other stuff. The adventure types, there are 10 different adventure types. They're pretty common scenarios that we'd find in our games, like overland travel, dungeon delving, investigations and mysteries, infiltrations and heists, role-playing and intrigue, and so on. You know, combat, defense, and so on. Each of those have descriptions of how you customize the 8 steps for that particular adventure type. Other things that you need to consider when you're prepping that style of adventure. What are the procedures for running that style of adventure in play? What are the common procedures you're going to walk through when you're actually running it? What pitfalls are common for these kinds of adventures? And what do you do to overcome those pitfalls? So every one of those kind of 10 chapters talks about those specific pieces. And that idea of the adventure types is new to this book. I wrote it a little bit on my website originally, but they're about at least twice to 3 times the size of that in the book now. And they include tons of random tables in there to give ideas about, like, what are the kinds of typical outcomes that you're looking for when you're doing an infiltration and heist? What are the kinds of complications that you might run into, and so on? So that's a big piece. And the Lazy GM toolkit that's in here, there was like a Lazy GM toolkit in Return that had, I think, like 6 kind of big ones. This one has like 61 of paragraph-sized tips, tricks, and tools that you can kind of grab onto, be like, there's like a unique thing that I can drop into my game that might make it easier, with the intention that you're going to, you know, scan them all, read the ones that you're interested in, grab the ones you really like, put them in your mental, your mental toolkit or a physical toolkit,
right?
Because some of them are actual physical things, and then, you know, try out in your game. So those are probably the ones where somebody who's read everything else is going to get that. One of the nice things I had is I had been releasing the book, I don't know if it was chapter by chapter, but it was pretty close to that, where I was releasing it over time to folks on my Patreon. These people are familiar with my work, right? They've read the books. They're familiar with this stuff. And so they got a chance to dive in. And I got a lot of good feedback on it, but none of the feedback was, you know, you're just rewriting the same stuff you already have, right? Like, nobody said that. They were finding useful things. I got a lot of useful feedback about the practicality of it. And I think it ended up pretty well. The good news is that Kickstarter also has a 36-page preview, so people can go see it themselves. Like, it has, of those 4 big chunks I talked about, there are chapters that cover each of those 4 chunks in the preview. So you can be like, here's what he's talking about with campaign planning. Dungeon crawling is the adventure type that we stuck in that book.
So what is it you enjoy most out of doing RPG advice content?
Writing it. I love sitting and writing, right? That's my favorite part. Hearing people's stories about how it got used. Sometimes it just amazes me. I'm always waiting for like a group of people to show up at my door and be like, you know, we tried this. It totally doesn't work. So whenever I hear people that are actually using the stuff and it's working for them, that's clearly a big charge. Because like, I'm not under any kind of impression that like I've found the holy grail of lazy GM prep or of prep in general, and all of the other ones should bow before this one, right? Like everybody's got a different style when it comes to prep, and there's no wrong answers in a lot of this stuff. A thing I continually hammer when people are like, I don't think I'm doing the 8 steps right, or I'm not doing secrets and clues correctly. I'm like, if it's working for you, you're doing it right. Like I don't, you know, they don't owe you anything. The 8 steps are not, you don't serve the 8 steps. The 8 steps serve you. And that might mean it's 6 steps, not 8, right? That might mean it's 9 steps, right? Like you get to kind of customize them around what style works for you. That's a big piece of what I kind of promote overall, but particularly in this book too. But I'm always really happy. The thing that I really kind of get a charge out of is when I hear people that are using it and that it's working well for them, it's making their lives easier.
This is kind of an addendum to that question. Have you gotten feedback from like new GMs who are stepping into it, have found your stuff really useful?
Yeah. So it's funny. The original Lazy Dungeon Master in the beginning, in the intro, I'm like, you probably want to be an intermediate GM before you start trying this stuff. Like, you probably want to have a bunch of games under your belt before you start getting wild and not, you know, doing less prep, right? Like you're going to want to get some baseline ideas in there. And between writing the Lazy Dungeon Master and writing Return of the Lazy Dungeon Master, I got a lot of feedback from people like, man, I'm brand new and I picked up your book and it immediately helped. And I was like, wow, okay, that surprised me. So in return, I was like, this can help you as a new GM, but you're going to want to at least know your rule system. You're going to have an idea about how RPGs work. And I say the same thing in Rise, that like, you know, there's a baseline understanding of this isn't going to teach you how to play an RPG. The RPG you buy is going to do that. But this is going to teach you or offer up a method for game prep that works with a lot of other RPGs.
Right.
And continually now it's been, I think, 12 years or so since I wrote the original book. But yeah, I've gotten a lot of new GMs, and particularly in the last few years, because there's a lot more new GMs in the hobby overall.
Oh, yeah.
And that's really why I felt like it's time for me to capture a lot of the stuff that I've heard and put it back into a new book. In that 8 years, the hobby has almost quadrupled.
Mm-hmm.
According to Wizards of the Coast's, you know, estimates on just D&D, D&D has quadrupled in like the last 8 to 10 years. And that's wild, because you're like, that means 1 in 4 GMs have only been playing in that amount of time. They've never played a version other than 5th edition D&D, for example. They didn't play 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 4th, or whatever, right? They didn't, you know.
Which amazes me, because someone sees that data and still thought that sticking the cartoon kids into everything was going to be a major selling point.
Right, yeah, no kidding. Right, like somebody somewhere is going to love that stuff. You're like, okay, like nobody knows what you're talking about.
Yeah, a bunch of us recognized it, but where's the new fresh blood in things.
Mm-hmm. But now they're all big on Karlach, right? Oh, Karlach's on the cover of every book. So
love Karlach.
Everyone loves Karlach. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a whole other thing, but it's so weird seeing some of the things in the new Forgotten Realms books having the cartoon kids and then other things having Baldur's Gate 3 characters.
You're like, there's like 40 years difference between
these
two.
You can tell they got as many art orders for Baldur's Gate 3 in as possible to replace things.
Oh, yeah, there, sure, the sure. Yep. Good money in that IP.
Yeah. So do you find that there's some advice that is very specific to a specific type of RPG? For example, like, advice that doesn't work really well for a game that isn't level-based. That sort of thing that just doesn't translate as well.
One of the things that I kind of spent some time with was trying to understand why the 8 steps are working as well as they're working. And because, you know, you're like, I wrote them, but I don't know. Like, I'm shocked at when people are like, oh, it works well in here. And I think one of the reasons why is that most of the steps are tied specifically to in-world things. They're not tied to kind of gamified things. In most games, you have things like scenes and secrets and locations and NPCs and monsters and treasure. Right. The characters themselves. Right. You know, those are pretty common across all of them, which means as long as the game has that stuff, it can fit. You know, there's obvious ones like Fiasco, where it's not going to work well with Fiasco. But probably the only one where I found that the 8 steps didn't work particularly well, and I'm not even sure if it is overall or just me, was Blades in the Dark. And that's because Blades in the Dark has such a procedural play during the game where that shifts the story in so many different ways. The 8 steps are not designed to build like a single railroaded path of an adventure. They are designed so that you can custom build scenes on the fly that make sense based on the way the story goes, right? They're designed to be very flexible. But Blades is even goes beyond further than that of the players are bringing a lot of the new stuff to it.
Yeah.
So I had a little bit of trouble getting the eight steps to work well with Blades. And I always felt, I always referred to it as like, I felt like Indiana Jones on the back of the truck getting dragged down the road while the truck is roaring on. Like my whole Blades campaign felt that way. Right? Yeah. I was like, I'm never catching up. Like their characters are running and doing stuff. And I'm like, wait.
I think Forged in the Dark, the best you can do there is maybe have some snippets for different factions or characters. And you realize most of the stuff will never come up. But at least if it does, I got something gold that I can throw in here. I ran Scum and Villainy for a while. Was like, I don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah, which can be great. And in my game, like I run lots of games where I have no idea what's going to happen, but I at least have some like, well, it's going to probably take place in this ruined castle. and you're like, no, I'm Blades, maybe not. Right? Like it could be anywhere. So and also I think like when I ran, it's been 6 years or so, 5 or 6 years since I did that. And I also wondered if a lot of it was me just getting my hands around how Blades plays, because for me, it was a shockingly complicated game. Like it had a lot of different things going on, and you had character sheets and you had your gang sheet, and then you had like your location sheets and that the players were running. And there was a lot of sort of the move base was beyond what I was used to with a typical Apocalypse World or, you know, Powered by the Apocalypse game where, you know, you have your games and you have your playbooks.
Yeah, it's got some very heavy procedures related to things that in other games are very freeform and loose.
And I'm not criticizing Blades, because like a lot of the concepts from Blades I talk about in Rise by name. I'm like, clocks works really well, flashbacks works really well. Like there's a lot of idea. The whole infiltration and heist section talks about how, you know, like Blades is built to do those kinds of the heist based things. So there's a lot of synergy there. There's a lot of stuff that I like about it. But it was the one of all of the different RPG, I probably ran maybe a dozen different RPGs, you know, using eight steps myself, and talked to many people who've run many others. And I think that's the one where I was like, I don't know that there was a good alignment of the eight steps with the kind of things that you need when you're about to run a Blades game. And maybe the answer is you just don't really do that kind of prep at all.
Yeah.
It does make me kind of wonder now if you try to apply that to something like Band of Blades that has a specific progression that isn't quite as open-ended as like Blades in the Dark itself, if that would work. Yeah. But that's a whole other thing there.
Yeah, I think I've got Band of Blades. Yeah, I'm looking at it right now, but I don't think I've cracked it open. I bought it several. There was a sale and I got a bunch of books and I'm like, oh, Band of Blades, that looks really good. And
yeah, my shelf's over there. Yeah. There are many books that I own that I have not.
One day, right? One day I'll have a chance to dig that one out.
So you've been crowdfunding projects for quite some time.
Yeah, I think this is my 10th Kickstarter. Yeah.
Are there any major changes you've seen over those projects regarding how RPG crowdfunding functions?
Yeah, absolutely. So the business side of it has changed a ton in, you know, the 10 years. Like my first one was $2,500, right? Like I managed to scrape $2,500 to make a single scenario fate adventure called Aeon Wave, a cyberpunk fate adventure called Aeon Wave, which was great because like that was my chance to like, hey, how does this whole thing work? And the end result is a 28-page black and white booklet, right? Print on demand booklet. So that scale and scope, anybody that's getting started, I would start with a scale and scope like that just to understand all the things that you're going to have to do before you're like, I have a 3-volume hardcover book with ribbons and special covers as my first one, unless you're partnering with somebody else. I think this is true for pretty much everybody because like, you know, Numenera was the best-selling Kickstarter at the time, and I think it made $500,000, right? And everybody was like, wow, $500,000. And now we have $12 million, $13 million Kickstarters that have happened.
Yeah.
There's interesting benchmarks there because, yeah, Numenera was one, but then you get to like 7C.
Yeah.
And then you get into like now with Neon Odyssey.
Yeah, Neon
and,
Odyssey.
You know, things like that.
And Dungeon Crawler Carl.
Yeah, just amazing how high those things are going.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so there's a lot. I mean, having run them on the running side, you know, there's certainly more that has to go if you're, you know, depending on what you're doing. And actually, our Kickstarters are pretty sedate, right? Like we you know, we don't have $5,000 special packages, right? We have like, hey, we're making this book. We no longer do stretch goals, right? Like now we just like the goal is to make the book. Like that's what we're going to do. And the more people that are interested, that's great because that's the bigger the print run we can do. But we focus on like one book. You know, my wife and I both run our business together and both of us have talked about it. And we know that like if you can get an average pledge, this is like a little thing that doesn't really, you know, most folks don't really pay much attention to that aren't doing it. The higher your average pledge is, the more you can spend on marketing. So the more you have invested in marketing, the more people you can get in. I'm pretty sure that that's the difference between most seven-figure Kickstarters and six-figure Kickstarters, or less. And it's because if you can get like over $200, that means that the amount of money that you can spend on paid marketing per click goes way up because your margins are so much better. So that's why you see a lot of Kickstarters that have extra dice and plushies and, you know, special collector versions with ribbons and everything like that. But then you also have to make all that stuff, right? And it's like if you're a small company, I'm in a two-person company, right? And neither of us are full-time. So it's like, you know, who's going to manage the SKU on a plushie, right? For, you know, for our special plushie tier. And we're like, we don't want to make plushies. Like, I'm not going to. Like, they can make whatever they want. But like, we're like, how about we do the one thing we know how to do? Like, we finally, during COVID, we figured out how to do offset printing. We're just going to keep doing that because that works for us. We know the guy. We know the company we work with. We've been through the process before. We know we'll succeed. And it's easy for us to manage. The store gets one new SKU, right? It's much simpler.
Everyone picked up a hobby during COVID. Yours was offset printing.
Ours was offset printing, right? Which was, boy, we went in the deep end of the pool really quickly. The old way that Kickstarter worked is still going on. You know, I have a friend of mine, Jeff Stevens, who does Kickstarters very often. And his are never these like $2 million things. They're him making a zine. Mm-hmm. And he makes a zine and he makes it print on demand and he sends it out almost as soon as the Kickstarter is done. And it works, right? And you get a cool product for it. And so there's still that capability for people to do that. But I think there's also like the engine of the Kickstarter got bigger and bigger and bigger. And some of the big ones are usually, I mean, like if you look at Neon Odyssey and you look at the list of the creators, it's like 50 people. It's huge, right? The list of the people involved in the Kickstarter are huge. So, you know, that's a big, complicated operation to run.
Yeah.
Good on them. Like they're making, one thing I'll say is, holy cow, the product quality is through the roof.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, picking on Monte Cook Games again. For the $500,000 Kickstarter they did, boy, that book is really nice. Mm-hmm. Like it was beautiful. The art direction was great. The design was great. I think I still have the original. I don't know. I might have gotten rid of the original because I got the other one, the newer ones. But like their product design was always fantastic. But the other thing I've seen is like last year in particular, I was getting a lot of review copies of things that people were making Kickstarters for. And every one of them, like, oh my God, these are good. Like Dolmenwood, beautiful box set.
Oh,
Nimble.
Dolmenwood is gorgeous.
Dolmenwood is gorgeous. Yeah. And the funny thing, Dolmenwood cracks me up because, you know, a lot of times I get a Kickstarter. That one, I didn't get a review copy of that. I backed it and received it. I think it took a little while. It was like a two-year delivery for that one. And I forgot what I had ordered, which happens to me. I back a lot of Kickstarters. So I don't know what I get until it shows up at the door and I open it. It's like Christmas. And I get it and I open it. And it, first of all, I like threw my back out, lifting it off the stoop to get in the house. Because like this box is huge. And then I open it up and I'm like, oh my God. And the very first thought I had when I started going through it was, how much did I pay for this? Right? Like, what did I pay? Like, I don't know. And then it was like, I think I paid like, it was like 150, you know, it was $150 for 8 hardcover books and a cloth map. And like, I was like, oh my God, somebody lost money, right? Like this is not, you know, I now know how much it costs to run these things. And I'm like, that's a very low profit margin on this, right? That's a $500 box, right?
Oh, or maybe, you know, so gorgeous.
$200 or $300 box. Yeah. But I got like one after the other, you know, just tons of them, you know, Land of Eam, Nimble, JP Covert just did one for Dragontown. And I opened up the box for that. They're just, I'm jealous of all of them, right? Because I'm making these kinds of things. I'm like, I'm not making stuff like this. Like these are really, really amazing stuff made by a lot of times by independent folks. Like Dolmenwood was just Gavin Norman, right? And Dragontown was just JP Covert, and Nimble was just Evan Diaz, right? They're one creator that makes all these things. But boy, did they nail that whole process of production that I think really came to a peak. You know, last year in particular was the year where I just got many of these that I was really impressed with how good they are.
Kickstarters really are Christmas presents for your future self.
They really are. You pay now, right? It's like the reverse of, I guess it's kind of, it's like reverse layaway, right? Because you're paying for the whole thing right away. You know, and mine is always like Dwarven Forge. Like I'm a Dwarven Forge nut, you know, and boy, those are like, I spent the price of a car on, you know, a bunch of Dwarven Forge stuff. But then you get them and you're like, oh, like look at all these little light up things that I got. Right. And it's always really fun. And you're like, and the money was spent 2 years ago. So it's like, it's free. It's almost like it's free.
It's funny too, because like seeing the form of the thing that you get can very much alter your perception of it too, because I had the electronic versions of all the Crooked Moon stuff.
Yeah.
And I didn't see the books until I went to a game store. And then I saw the books sitting there on the shelf.
Yeah.
These just massive things that were like the size of my grandma's family Bible.
Yeah. 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 My friend Sean Merwin was one of the people that worked on Crooked Moon. And he got like the deluxe set. And we were just on a chat and he was like, you know, and he was like, it's like a cube. Where you need like a fork, it's two. He's like, they call it a box set, but it's two boxes because it's one that's just the accessories and then one that's the books. And he goes, and the book one weighs a ton. And he goes, it's just, it's like Mary Poppins carpet bag. It's just got everything going on in there.
I got the Grim Hollow one not that long ago. And that was another one that just had a massive amount of stuff in there.
Yeah. And that's kind of a big difference too, because there's a lot of companies that are involved in making this stuff now, right? Ghostfire Games made a lot of board game kind of stuff before they got into doing RPG work. So they have that experience of supply lines and all the different vendors that they have to talk to make this stuff. And they've got all that sort of wired in. So then they can have these big, beautiful box sets with lots of cool accessories, and they can get their average pledge up, which means they can put a lot more towards marketing and get a lot more people back in the Kickstarters. So yeah, they have a real advantage. You know, there's a real advantage in that. And that's, you know, when you go back to like, how has it changed? I'd say like that to me is kind of the biggest way that I've seen it change, which I think is a net positive, right? I think like it's good. You know, I think, again, we're getting these amazing products that we wouldn't get otherwise.
Yeah.
So I know listening to you for a while on various different shows, you've mentioned about how a lot of people engage with your blog now via newsletter rather than the content of the actual blog.
Yeah, about 5 to 1.
Do you have any thoughts on that, especially in light of people still blogging in the modern age?
Sure.
Some of us may be asking for reasons.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm always, you know, I'm not going to give it to you guys because you keep beating me at the Ennies, right? Like,
it's been a long time.
I was
time.
The silver to your gold like 4 years in a row. Yeah. I don't remember who it was in Gnome Stew, but I think it was to my wife, Michelle, where somebody said, yeah, for a small blog, you're doing really well or something like that. So still mad about that. So I've been quote unquote blogging since like literally the late 90s when there weren't blogs. Like I was writing on the web, articles on the web before there was a name for it. And it's because I love it. I love doing it. You know, Sly Flourish is going to come up on 20 years.
Wow.
It's 18 years now and it'll be about 20 years in a couple of years. And that's about half of the time I've spent blogging. And so I've been writing for the web for so long. I mean, maybe not 40 years, but 30, you know, and I'm not going to stop. Right. Like, and it's like, it doesn't matter if like, a lot of people for years, oh, Twitter, it's going to kill blogs. No one's going to blog anymore. Twitter's going to do it. That was 15 years ago. Google Reader is going to kill blogs. No one's going to ever bother blog. You're just going to put your RSS feed up and you know, Google Reader will eat it. And they're all gone. Now it's Google Zero, right? Oh, LLMs are going to tell everything everybody ever wants to know about RPGs. No one's ever going to go to a blog again. I'm looking at my data and the data is, my blog's gone up, right? Other people are talking about how their hits are cratering. I think part of the reason is some of the folks where their hits are cratering were aiming to try to get people to get to their site through SEO.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't have data on this, but it wouldn't surprise me. Like, I know that some people were like, yeah, I had content that was specifically designed to hit these sort of niche markets that I had discovered through this that now are getting hit other ways. And I've always been like, I'm going to write what I write and hopefully people come. And some of them people get really excited about and some don't. The one piece of advice that I wish I had given to myself when I started this whole thing in like in 2008 or whatever was start a newsletter, right? Like, because I could have done it then. And there have been newsletters forever too, right? Email is older than the web. So I could have done that. And I've often thought like, how many people would have subscribed to me by then? But now my subscribers have kind of hit a certain level. And I'm like, I think it'd probably be about the same amount. I don't know that an extra 10 years of newsletter subscribers over time, because people leave, people come in, new people come in and new people go, or old people go. So like, I think that I don't feel like I have this big miss like I did when I first started. I'm totally happy to write articles that end up going out as a newsletter and then get archived as a, or, you know, archived as a blog article.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, there's no reason to not have both. I like having a website that I can point to, that I can send people to, where they can go get an article. Again, the whole thing's under a Creative Commons non-commercial license, so you can literally download the whole website in a single zip file and put it on your own local computer and open up and read every article. You know, I like that portability to it. So it's been a big change. Probably the biggest change has been the writing style, where I used to write like 1,000 to 2,000 word articles, and I just don't think people have that kind of patience anymore. And I don't even know if that's a blog versus a newsletter thing, but now I'm aiming for that more, that 500 word sort of angle.
Yeah. And I think, well, you said, like, you know, people were saying TikTok and that type of thing was going to kill the blogs, and like, it did take some of the attention.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there's still a place for the long form discussion on things.
Right. It's not going away. Yeah. There, I guess there's like a perception that a new thing comes in and eats the old thing.
Mm-hmm.
And in some cases, that might be true. But in a lot of cases, I don't think it is. In a lot of cases, the old thing is still the old thing. And it stays around. And you're not going to get the same kind of visibility. So I do think that TikTok and short form video is eating is the wrong phrase, is growing a lot of attention that might not have been there otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
I will say that, like, my YouTube presence has gone down, and I think that that is due to short form versus long form video.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But again, I've often, there's some people who are like, oh, I got to quit YouTube. My views are down. So I'm going to quit making videos. And I'm like, I was making videos and nobody was watching, right? Like, you know, so why would I stop now? Right? Like, there's still people watching.
It's also hard to tell, because they could change something in the algorithm and completely shift what is actually being delivered to people.
Yeah.
Because I've listened to a bunch of people that are primarily, you know, YouTube creators that have talked about how, like, all of a sudden everything cratered because something changed and I don't know what it is, so I can't adapt to it.
Yeah, and the good news for me is mine didn't crater. Mine just declined. Right? And there's still people watching. There's still more people that, you know, watch it now than did, you know, pre-COVID. So I'm happy. And, you know, again, same way, like, I do a talk show on YouTube, but it's also a podcast. The podcast definitely gets fewer listens than the YouTube gets views. But why not both, right? Why not put it in lots of places? And it's the kind of work I like to do. I like doing 1 hour talk shows. You know, I'll take clips from it and do shorter form videos, and that's fine.
I also think it's funny too, though, because when you talk about something killing off blog, people will act like something like Substack or Ghost is significantly different than blogs.
It's the same thing. Yeah,
it's like, it is a blog. Yeah, it's right. Just a more bundling of stuff together.
Substack's an interesting one. First of all, you know, it's got its own problematic issues, but also, it's got this kind of weird algorithmic angle to it as well, that people I know who publish on Substack really say, like, oh, it brings a lot of people in that wouldn't find it otherwise, in a way that just a regular blog doesn't. But you're like, you know, I don't know. There's something else. It's another one where, like, are you actually, do you own your content there or not? Or is it really Substack that owns the content?
Yeah.
Ghost is different. I think Ghost is an open source one, and it's very similar to a blog platform. And I'm the kind of dorky nerd who, like, long ago said, I'm not using WordPress anymore. I'm going to write my own CMS, and literally wrote my own CMS in Python that I've now used and abused for the last 15 years or whatever, and, you know, refactored every so often. And it just dumps, it just creates static HTML files. So the whole website's 100% static, which, you know, it's the most boring website on the planet, which is why I get the silver instead of the gold. I guarantee you, whatever we say about our sites, I almost guarantee my site is faster.
You are probably
super,
correct.
Super, super fast. It's really, really optimized for speed.
Switching topics slightly, how many different RPG publishers have you worked with as a freelancer, and how did those experiences differ?
Sure. A lot. I couldn't count them all off the top of my head, but I've worked with a lot of them. I've worked with Wizards of the Coast, MCDM, Kobold Press, Arcane Library, Pelgrane Press, and Sasquatch Games, and a bunch. And I've had a lot of different experiences with them. All of them good. I don't know that I've ever... No, okay. There's one bad one. There was one bad experience. I won't name names. It wasn't a big publisher, though. I'll say that. Almost all the time, pretty positive. You know, there's different things when you're working with a bigger publisher like Wizards of the Coast, where they have kind of a... They have a big accounting system, right? You're getting, you know, kind of badged into Hasbro, right, when you're involved. And... You know, and that means their system just operates at a different pace and a different scale than almost everybody else does. almost everybody else, like, it's if you bug them, you'll get paid, right? Like, you write your thing, you'd submit your thing, you say, where do I send the invoice? This one thing I'll say to, like, freelancers, because I think people, I hear a lot of concern. I don't know if I've heard this recently, from kind of newer freelancers who kind of, you know, are angry that they're not getting paid quickly, but not bugging the people that should be paying.
Oh,
them.
Yeah. You gotta bug the people they're supposed to pay you.
Everyone's super busy. And a lot of folks, including the folks that are running it, are not super particularly organized. And so I'm always like, I will forget if I don't bug you right now. Like, you know, and so I'm polite about it. I don't hound them, but I'll be like, I have submitted what you have asked for. To whom do I send the invoice? Can I send you a PayPal invoice so you could just click it and pay and be where transactions complete? And almost everybody handles it that way. And I've had I don't think I've had a problem of anybody paying my bills, you know, paying whatever the commission was. I don't think I've ever really had a problem with, like, a lot of extensive rewrites that I wasn't expecting to get. I hear horror stories pretty often, and it could be that I've just been very lucky that, mm-hmm. that, you know, I haven't gone through a lot of situations where the scope creep kicked in and a project was way harder than it should have been. The best ones are the ones where I actually get to kind of, like, work with a veteran designer. And this happened early on. One bit of freelancing work that I did that I'm extremely happy about and really humbled by was working with Pelgrane Press on 13th Age.
Ooh.
And I got the chance to work directly with Rob Hainso on the material I was doing for that. And there was one time where I wrote something and I submitted it. And Rob, I think, emailed me back and he said, there are two ways we can approach this. One way, I can thank you for the work and we can edit it on our side and we'll publish it and it'll be fine. The other way is I can work with you and talk about what you submitted and we can dive into that if you want. And I'm like, yes, I would, like the second. And he gave me really good advice that I've taken to this day, right? That I've taken ever since. On just like, I mean, it was a handful of pieces that I did for them. But the feedback that I got from him in particular, and some of the other companies don't operate that way, right? Like, you know, I don't think I'm calling them out, but like Wizards of the Coast is really busy and then everyone's working really hard. They don't really give you feedback, you know, the kind of feedback that you're going to be able to take and say, this is feedback that I'm going to be able to learn from and work on in the future.
Right.
The best you can do is look at what you had submitted and look at what made it into the print and then say, I see what they did.
Yeah, I was going to say.
And even then, you got to have a pretty good eye for what the changes were.
I know some people that have freelanced for Wizards and they're kind of like, oh, look, some of what I wrote made it in.
Yeah. Well, that's the other thing. Like, you know, something else that I've always... I got an early lesson in this. I think, I don't even know if I got a lesson. I took this philosophy early, which is like, when I'm writing a product for somebody else, it's not, from the minute the word hits the page, it's not mine anymore. It's theirs, right? Mm-hmm. Every word is their word. And so whatever they want to do with it is fine. And I wrote a bunch of stuff for Wizards for Dragon Magazine. And I think there was Fast and Furious and we're doing a bunch. I think I had 10 different things that I wrote for them over a couple of years. At least one didn't make it at all. It was not submitted. It never made it into a book. And I'm like, well, whatever, right? Like, you know, I wrote this thing that nobody ever gets to see again. And I didn't even know if it was particularly good. So it probably, you know, I don't know that the world lost anything by it not getting published. But you're like, well, I'm not doing it for the money. I'm doing it also so that people can, you know, to do this work. But in that circumstance, you know, that can happen, right? And something you can work heavy on something and it cannot happen. The one that I had that was a bad experience is I was working with a group and I knew that their group was shaky to begin with. Like they had an event planned and they wanted material done for that event. And they commissioned me for it. It was a relatively small commission, but you know, they were offering a decent pay rate at the time. I was working on it and it was a big project. And this is one where they had a bunch of us working on it. There were several, like, you know, 6, 8, 10 people that were working on it. And the deadlines are moving along and I'm not hearing anything. And meanwhile, I'm watching what is happening with the project that it's supposed to support. And that looks like it's floundering. And I'm like, this thing that I'm writing, the idea that it's actually ever going to happen seems really low. And it was a 15,000 word project. So it was like a pretty chunky project that I was going to work on. And I wonder what everybody else is doing. So the deadline's coming up. I had a couple weeks and I said, okay, I've procrastinated enough. I got a couple weeks on the deadline. I'm gonna ask, and I said, hey, I noticed that this thing is going in this direction. Are we sure that this is going to happen? Do you still want me to work on this? I haven't really started yet. And they said, yes. don't worry, you're good. Everything's going to be fine. It's going to work out. And I said, okay. And then they sent an email to everybody else saying, hey, no one has actually submitted anything except Mike. And I'm like, I'm the sucker in that, right? Like the other people who didn't do anything, yeah, they blew their deadlines, but they knew, they knew what I didn't. And then sure enough, like I did it and I spent, you know, 2 weeks writing it or whatever. And I sent it in and I got paid half of what I was supposed to get paid and it never got published. And I knew it and I'm still mad, right? And it was because like I wrote and I was, the thing that was so painful is while I was writing it, I knew it wasn't going to work, right? Like during the project, I was like, I know in my bones that this thing that I'm working on hard is never, never going to be published. And maybe I'm never even going to get paid for it. And yeah, that was a mess. So that was one where like I should have, you know, really doubled down on my instinct of like, I think this is a mess. And there are times where like you're working with small groups. It's not even anybody's fault other than the fact that they told me, keep going.
Yeah.
When they knew it wasn't working.
Yeah.
And I knew it wasn't working. And everyone else, because nobody else submitted anything. And I talked to them later, like, yeah, we knew that wasn't going to work. And I was like, you know, I know, but I don't blow deadlines, right? Like, this is one thing I don't do. If you give me a deadline, I'll meet it. And so don't. You know, so that was really bad. And, but I, you know, boy, the number of stories I have about working with groups where they were super open to the work and happy, you know, like all MC, again, MCDM, wonderful to work with. My friend James Intercasso and everybody else that I worked with there, really, really good. Arcane Library, working with Kelsey. I wrote a forward to one of the new books that she's got coming out and I've done, I think I've done something else for her too. Fantastic to work with. So lots, again, like, you know, working with Pelgrane Press, working with Kobold Press. I've written a ton of stuff with Kobold Press and always really enjoyed that experience. So, you know, yeah, been really happy with the work that I've done.
Is there anybody, either company or game system wise, that you haven't worked with that you would like to?
I don't think so. And I've hit the stage now where I really have to balance, is it better to write for myself or better to write for someone else? I'm pretty happy having published with who I've published with. But now I'm at the point where I'm turning down work from really big publishers because I'm like, I've got my own thing I'm working on now. Even if I had the bandwidth for it, there's like an extra sort of mental load of knowing you've got another project for somebody that is coming up and that you got to work on, even if it's not particularly hard. Some of my favorites are like writing a monster for somebody's monster book is great because it's like, it's, you know, 2 hours of work and I get a credit. You know? So it's like that, you know, I get to add it to my bio page that I worked with, you know, publisher X, you know, and or I got a book that I wrote a piece of and it was not a lot of work, right? It's a pretty easy thing. So that kind of stuff is good. But there's, you know, I mean, it sounds arrogant as hell, right? But looking across at, you know, the products that have come out, a lot of them I have written for. And then the others, I have to say, like, I've got my own projects that I'm excited about. You know, I'm already working on my next book while I'm also working on Rise Now. And I've got a Patreon that is, you know, always thirsty for any of the stuff that I want to make. And they're paying me too. So, you know, I have this opportunity where it's almost always more valuable to write on my own angle than it is to write for others. But it definitely comes up, you know, when Kelsey Dionne says, hey, would you like to write an intro to the book that you talked about as your campaign for many years? I'm like, yeah, sure. Right. Like that's, you know, and also different kinds of work are easier. Right. So if somebody's like, hey, we want you to write a 10,000 word adventure. That's pretty hard. Right. Adventure writing for me is actually one of the harder bits of writing. If somebody's like, hey, we want a 500 word piece about encounter balance in 5e. I'm like, sure. You know, like I can write that really easily. Right. I've written 100 things like that before.
Speaking of your own writing, have you ever thought of doing revised versions of any of your older adventure books? Or do you think they hold up well as is?
I don't know if it's either. So I am very proud of the work. And I look at books, so like Fantastic Adventures and Fantastic Locations were two of the earliest books that I had done. I think they were my second and third Kickstarters. There's definitely parts when I look back on Fantastic Adventures and say like, oh, that's something we could have done. Like, I don't know, keying the maps would have been nice, right? And so there's little things like that. But I also have lots of people who play them and run them and still like them. And I don't get, you know, I mean, maybe I'm not going to get complaints, but like, I don't really have, I've not really run into people like, yeah, I tried it and it wasn't really that good or I didn't like it. Like those adventures, and I've had other people who have talked about running them recently. They're like, these are some of the best adventures I've ever run. And I also don't know that I believe that, right? Like, you know, that's very nice. Long way of saying, I think they already work. and I don't think I need to do them again. But there's a practical side, which is like a rewrite of an old book is not going to sell very well.
Mm-hmm.
And a new thing is going to be a lot easier to build the marketing around and get people excited about. And there's a bunch of people, like, if I'm like, oh, I want to update Ruins of the Grendel Root, even doing things like taking Ruins of the Grendel Root is a book I did a few years ago. And I love it. And I'm very proud of it. That's one where I don't think it necessarily needs a rewrite. But like, I could rewrite it and make it less 5e based, right? Oh, I'm going to make a Shadow Dark version of Ruins of the Grendel Root. And people are like, oh, I'd love that. But it's still not going to sell as well. And I'd be better off just making another adventure book. Right.
Yeah.
And I've always got new ideas for things like that. The business side, especially when you're talking about needing to do print runs and offset printing and stuff like that, you kind of need to hit a level of attention and a level of excitement about it to be able to warrant doing like a 2000, you know, 2000 is about as small a print run as you can do where the profit margin's good enough to be able to account for shipping and moving things around and everything else. I mean, I suppose you could probably do cheaper than that. You could do 500 or anything like that. But I think your price goes up per unit every time you do that. And so the math doesn't work out as much.
The math ain't mathin.
Yeah, the math ain't mathin. And I, yeah, so I always think like it's probably better to do a new thing. Yeah, so I don't really want to make a sequel because people get confused whether they need to own the first one.
Right.
So that was a good friend of mine gave me that advice when I was doing Ruins of the Grendel Root. And I was going to call it Fantastic Adventures 2, Ruins of the Grendel Root. And she was like, I don't know if that's a good idea, because then they're going to think they need the first one, and then but maybe they don't really want the first one. So then they're just like, I just won't buy either.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, we'll just make that a label. We'll just call it Fantastic Adventures and give it a new name that makes it unique and interesting. So I did that. And I think I would continue. Same I'm doing with my current, the new book I'm working on. I don't know why I'm pipping a book that's going to be out in 2 years. But like, I'm working on a book that's kind of tied to City of Arches, but also not really. Right? Like, again, both independent books. Both could sit alongside one another well. You don't need either, right? Like that to me feels like it's an easier thing to kind of manage.
I will say that your pregens that were in your adventures are some of the best pregens that I have ever seen, and I used those multiple times even when I wasn't using those adventures, because they were so easy to just present to somebody and say, just make a couple choices and here you go.
There was part of us that was like, do we want to make five, you know, D&D 2024 versions of those to update them? So yeah, we worked really hard on those. We did those for Fantastic Adventures and then updated them for Ruins of the Grendel Root. Eric Nowak was the designer of that. We commissioned him specifically to make a flexible character sheet that we could customize for every class and also include enough information to run them up to fifth level on one sheet. And then James Intercasso of MCDM actually designed the characters for them using all 5.1 SRD stuff and went through all those. And then I think we went through a couple rounds of hey, you forgot this one spell. And then we made a mistake we made early on was not including spell sheets. And we had like the list of spells, but not the actual spell descriptions. And everyone's like, oh, this is a pain in the ass. So I made a Word version that had all the spell stuff on it. And then we went back during Grendel Root, went back to Eric and said, can you make nicely formatted spell sheets for these guys too? And he did that too. And then we had, I think it's like a 96 page character folio that we make. It's for free, right? It's available for free on either the Grendel Root or the Fantastic Adventures website has it for your download. And it includes all the characters for all the classes up to fifth level on the same page, plus a bunch of background stuff. And it's designed to be printable front and back. If you just send it straight to a printer and go front and back, it will print everything correctly. So you won't have one half of a class on another half sheet. Like, they're designed across the board. And it was a ton of work and very expensive. And I don't, and then we were like, oh, should we do that for City of Arches? I'm like, it's kind of a system agnostic book. Like, I don't know that we need it now. So I don't think we're going to be doing that for Michelle has talked about it. My wife and business partner has been like, we should do that for that. I'm like, okay, you're on charge. It took a lot of work and we got a lot of things to do. So we haven't gotten around to doing that yet. But yeah, thank you for that. I'm glad you liked them. Yeah.
Oh yeah. I was going to say my group that I'm running Curse of Strahd for now, all of those characters are original, but when a lot of them played for the first time, either they were brand new to D&D or they were brand new to 5e.
Yeah,
and that really helped a lot to just say, okay, you want to play right away.
Yeah.
We're not going to dig into all of this stuff. Here is a character. There you go.
Yeah. Yeah. Part of me is bitter that Wizards doesn't do that, right? Like, how come they don't have like a single click downloadable zip of like, hey, here's 12 classes that go up to fourth level or whatever?
Yeah.
It's kind of a bummer. And they're just like, hey, I use D&D Beyond. You're like, okay.
Yeah. It is one of the barriers to entry because like the character sheet can be so overwhelming for new players.
It is. It's a lot. And yeah, having to look up spells and having to look up like what you're, you know, now you got weapon masteries and stuff and you'd have to include that.
Yeah.
It's a lot of material, yeah. And that's the thing. Like, I'm playing a lot of other lightweight games, and you know, I'll keep going back to Shadowdark. That, like, I think, you know, if I'm running new players through a game, I'm running Shadowdark because it's, you know, Arcane Library has fantastic character sheets on, like, nice index cards that you can hand to people and just run. You know, it's great.
We ended up switching our game to Shard, even though we play face-to-face, because they were getting so confused about preparing spells in D&D Beyond.
Yeah.
Because it is not as intuitive as you would think.
No. I had a friend of mine who I played with for many years, and it was late into, I don't know how many campaigns we played, but it was a lot of campaigns. And one time he cast like 3 fourth level spells in 3 rounds, and he was only like 7th level. And one of the other players is like, didn't you spend all your 4th level spell slots? And he's like, what do you mean? And they're like, you only have so many times. He's like, I thought if I had the spell, I could cast as many times as I want. We're like, how long have you been doing that? He's like, 5 years. And we're like, oh my God, right? Like, for all this time, we're like, we have to invalidate all our previous campaigns, right? Like, we're going back and wiping those clean because that, you should not have been able to do that. So,
got
to
do an audit.
So yeah, it's because it's complicated, right? Like understanding all that stuff's really tough.
Getting us wrapped up and getting out of here. For the people that haven't engaged with your content before, what do you think is the most valuable thing they will get from Rise of the Lazy Game Master?
The theme of the book is the same as the whole Lazy GM principle, which is getting more out of your game by preparing less, running a better game with less prep. The big thing that somebody new to RPGs will get is the recognition of preparing for your game so that it flows at the table, so that it expands at the table, so it grows at the table, instead of you walking in with a predetermined story and then getting immediately mad when they all decide to go in a direction you didn't expect. For GMs, both new and old, you're getting a life raft and a great big open sea of possibility and not having any idea what to do, because most RPGs are not helping you figure out what you need to do from session to session and how you prep your game. And I'm giving a life raft that says, here is a process. It's worked for a lot of people. It may not be the end all be all. It might not be the one you end up with, but here's a thing you can do to help you get your hands around the next game you're going to run. Starting step by step. Step one, step two, step three. Follow these to help get your hands around what's going on. And then the rest of the book kind of expands that out to say, here's how you take that to the entire process of building a campaign. Here's how you take this to these different kinds of adventures and adventure types that you're probably going to end up running. Here's a ton of examples. Here's a ton of tools that you can roll on to figure out what's going on. Ton of little, you know, high leverage tricks that you can run at your game that are going to make the game easier for you to run and more fun to play for your players.
That's awesome. So getting us out of here, the Gnomecast is part of the Polygamers Podcast Network. So if you're enjoying us, here's another show to check out.
Under the Lamplight. Under the Lamplight is the Streets of Avalon RPG companion podcast where Brett and Chris talk about the setting and the game. Streets of Avalon RPG is a low fantasy urban role-playing game focused on stories of people living in a city of classism, corruption, and decay while trying to bring a little light into their lives and to people closest to them.
You can find all us gnomes at gnomestew.com along with various gnome socials with various degrees of activity. Mike, where else can we find you on the internet?
Best place is slyflourish.com. Everything's linked off that page.
Awesome. And we will, in our show notes, have a link to both Sly Flourish and the Rise of the Lazy Game Master Kickstarter, which, how long does it go to? What's the end date?
Till August 6th. So we got a couple weeks as of this recording.
Yeah, so there will at least be a week after this recording drops for the public. So, do you think we were lazy enough to avoid getting thrown in the stew?
Sure.